Hello and welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher on this edition of our program, another installment in the Museum Confidential podcast, which is co-created by myself and Jeff Martin of Philbrook Museum of Art. This podcast is an extension of the On View exhibition at Philbrook called Museum Confidential, which is on view through early May. It's an exploration of the question, what goes on behind the scenes at a given museum? Also, how are museums changing at the outset of the 21st century? And what are museums for? Why do we go to museums? What are we looking for when we visit a museum? This podcast is the most recent installment. It was posted at the publicradiotulsa.org website earlier this month. And in this edition of the podcast, we hear from the New York-based poet Kenneth Goldsmith, who in 2013 was the first and only poet laureate at the Museum of Modern Art.
There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. When we think of museums, many of us imagine paintings hanging on a wall. But here in the 21st century, museums are much more. It's film, it's music, it's performance, and it's literature. In May 2017, the American Writers Museum opened in Chicago. The Dallas Museum of Art hosts a popular ongoing visiting author series called Arts and Letters Live. At Philbrook, over the past several years, we've hosted many book events, from the illustrator of The Stinky Cheese Man to the author of The Time Traveler's Wife. It seems that the literary arts are making their way into traditional museums like never before. In a few weeks, we'll even host a sold-out event with George Saunders, winner of the 2017 Man Booker Prize and recipient of what's known as the MacArthur Genius Grant. But today we're talking with acclaimed poet Kenneth Goldsmith about his life, his work, and what it was like being the first ever and only poet laureate at the Museum of Modern Art. In 2013, you had this year-long residency as the first poet laureate at MoMA. And I guess, how did that conversation even begin? When did that idea come about?
There was a program to bring artists into the museum. I can't remember the name of the program. And I think they chose about five or six artists to come into the museum. This was through education. And do whatever we wanted to do. So they were not actively soliciting a poet laureate. They sort of came up with that when I arrived. What do you want to do? How would you like to be the poet laureate? I said, okay, that sounds good to me. They sort of had this plan for me, though. It was called Artist Experiment.
Yeah, I think, you know, and since the time that you did this, you know, in the years since, I was looking, have they continued this? I couldn't see that.
No. What I learned was that they really don't care about poetry. I had a great time. I was able to do incredible things. But, you know, it's, even though, listen, the history of MoMA is, you know, ripe with poets. I mean, most notably Frank O'Hara, who in the 1950s was a curator at the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah, of course, Lunch Poems, yeah.
Yeah, and I had done several events there, and this all came through the education department. Over the years, I think like part of any museum, what they like to do is cultural enrichment, which includes, you know, always some panels, you know, and some readings, often poetry readings, around an exhibition. So over the years, I had been invited to do a few of those and a few presentations in various departments. And you're always kind of the poet, like the musician in the space of the museum is, you know, a paid entertainer. You know, it's a one-night stand. There's no commitment to you. Although the library was very active in collecting small press and poetry books and mail art books for many years. And there's sort of an interesting story that I can tell you. In the late 70s and early 80s, the librarian at MoMA was a British guy called Clive Philippot. And Clive kind of came out of ideas of mail art and cassette network underground culture and was plunked into being a librarian there. And he had this kind of amazing idea. He found a loophole in the museum whereby if anybody sent something to the library would be obliged to take that. And as a result, that artist could claim and legitimately claim that they were in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art. So this guy, Clive, put out this open call to all sorts of artists and poets and musicians, send me anything and you can say you are in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art, which was just such a great gesture. And of course, he began receiving crates and crates of materials, all of which he took, all of which had to be cataloged, all of which are still in the archives out in Queens. But it was that kind of democratizing gesture that is a way to break the hierarchy of the museum. And I was very inspired by that story. And I think I remember in the 80s having sent Clive something myself, you know, just so I could tell my mother that, you know, I was in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art. So what I like to talk about is the idea that it's really hard to get in through the front door of MoMA. Okay, it's hard. You're a painter, you're a sculptor, you're a performance artist or a poet. Very few people are going to have the front door opened. In other words, say, hey, come have a show in the galleries. The curators invite you. But the back door, which there literally is a back door entrance on MoMA on 54th Street, where the library and the education wing and the research wings are all located. And that door is open to almost anybody. And it democratizes the institution, which is by its nature extremely elitist and very difficult to get into. And it's almost like a funny loophole in the MoMA universe. And that is the kind of thing that I really wanted to exploit during my time there.
Speaking of that, you did this program that I loved reading about. I wish I had seen it in person, which was called Uncontested Spaces. These were guerrilla readings, basically pop-up events. Can you kind of tell us what that project was and how you pulled it together?
They basically said to me, you can do anything you want. And they gave me a pass, you know, an all-access pass. I could go anywhere. I could go into the archives. I could go into the storage units. And I thought to myself, what can I possibly do here? And in the idea of the democratizing gesture, the first thing I decided to do was set up a reading series in the galleries during gallery hours. Now, if I'm a poet and I go into MoMA through the front door and I start reading my poem in front of a Picasso painting, they're going to get me the hell out of there. You are not allowed to do that. But what I was able to do was create a weekly space for an artist or a cultural figure. I didn't want to just keep it to poets to come in and do whatever they wanted, which is, again, within the structure of the institution, very radical. They had no money for these poets, but I was able to buy them an expensive lunch in the MoMA Cafe, and that's about all I could offer them. But again, it's the MoMA name. I was able to get incredibly renowned people who were willing to do a reading for free simply because, again, it's MoMA. And the pull of that name is what I began to play with in order to get, you know, kind of heroes of mine to come and do something basically for nothing.
Are there one or two of those that kind of stood out to you, having done so many? The list of people you have, like Eileen Miles, for example, and Stefan Sagmeister, the great designer, and provocateur. Were there one or two of those that kind of stand out as highlights from that series?
Well, yeah, there are. I mean, Sagmeister is great. And, you know, again, I want to open it up, the idea that anybody, you know, who is a cultural figure, I assume that they would be interesting and they would do, you know, interesting readings. And one of the most wonderful ones that I did was with the graphic designer and illustrator, Myra Kalman. And Myra came in, and she went over to a Joseph Beuys felt suit. And everybody, I said, you know, what do you want to read in front of? You know, what speaks to you? And she went over in front of this Joseph Beuys suit, and she read a story, I believe, about one of her grandparents and a suit. I believe it was in Tel Aviv. And how it connected to Beuys and how it connected to modernism and design. And it was this beautiful, so I believe it was a story that Myra read there. There must have been six people there, but there is, you know, Myra Kalman reading an original story in front of a Joseph Beuys suit. Another great one that strikes me was the novelist Rick Moody, who is most famous for writing The Ice Storm.
Yeah, of course. He's great.
Rick is also a musician. And Rick said, can I sing in the gallery? I said, of course you can sing in the gallery. So Rick stood in front of a Rothko, and he took his guitar out, and he did a set of music in the gallery, which was just absolutely wonderful. And Rick loved it so much that when I sent him a picture of him doing it, that became like his Facebook profile picture for a while, standing in front of a giant Rothko, you know, with an acoustic guitar. But the best one and the weirdest one was I asked John Zorn, the musician, the jazz musician or avant-garde musician, to come in and do a reading. I said, John, come do a reading. And John said, look, I'll tell you what, it's my 60th birthday this year. Instead of just doing a reading, how about we do a series of concerts in the galleries over the course of 5 hours?
For free.
For free.
Wow.
You know, because I love MoMA. I grew up with MoMA. And I presented that idea to the staff, and the staff said, hey, let's make it happen. So John came in, and there were about 5 or 6 different concerts that happened. I remember one, the first one was very beautiful, in front of Monet's Water Lilies, with a xylophone and a harp, you know, like sound clouds in front of a Monet. There was an electronic music piece that was played again in the Joseph Boys room. There was a cello piece that was played in front of a Paul Klee piece. And the best of all was John Zorn himself and the percussionist Milford Graves went into the Abex room and in front of a giant Jackson Pollock for about a half hour made a racket, which was incredible. And the crowd for that was very, very large. The word had gotten out, but it was free. It was free with museum admission. Nobody got paid anything. I think I bought John lunch, you know, as a result of that.
So, you know, it seems like, you know, you were the poet laureate, for lack of any other title, but at the same time, you were a curator, you were an event planner. Is this something that personally, you know, do you have experience in putting together huge happenings?
Well, I've been doing a curatorial project for 22 years. It's an online site called UbuWeb, which is the largest site of avant-garde materials given again for free on the internet. So I was also a DJ on WFMU here in New York for a long time. And, you know, over the years, I worked with Hans-Ulrich Obrist to do giant poetry festivals and events with an organization that he runs called 89 Plus all over Europe. I organized a giant poetry marathon at the Serpentine Gallery in London. You know, over the years, I've done all sorts of things like this. So to me, it was, you know, it wasn't much different than putting stuff up on Ubu or putting a radio show together or doing a number of other events. Open up the space and let people do what they want to do. And if you get the right people and you get the right space, it's bound to succeed on some level.
Did you butt up against any resistance from the brass at the museum? I sure did.
They did not like the idea that they had a poet laureate and they, meaning the curatorial department, had not appointed the poet laureate. The name became a big point of contention. How dare the education department appoint a poet laureate when we are the curatorial people that appoint everyone and you didn't ask us?
They're the tastemakers, yeah.
It became a great institutional challenge. You know, listen, the education department, you know, education people in museums have always been sort of seen as the gym teachers of the art world, right? And here they are making a big stand. And boy, did we get blowback on that, to the point where I think at a certain point, they might have even wanted the education department to renege that or maybe put it in quotes or something like that. But it was too late because once the word got out, I was on Colbert, I was in the New York Times, and everybody wrote, MoMA's first poet laureate. And suddenly...
I recall a big piece in the New Yorker, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, tremendous amounts of press. And then suddenly they thought, maybe this isn't so bad. You know, I mean, they're always, you know, because they weren't going to give me any press, you know. I give nothing to them, but they were certainly glad to take it when I was able to generate it myself.
Those two words that were so loaded for them. You know, if you had been called writer in residence, they wouldn't have cared as much. Why do you think those two words carried so much controversy? Poet laureate. You
know, I mean, why does the word or the acronym MoMA carry so much weight? They understand the value of a brand, you know, there, and it's all about a brand. I mean, really what they do is very similar to what smaller museums do and probably better. But MoMA has got, you know, has got the big imprimatur.
And you used that. You used that, which was kind of fascinating. I think you smartly took that and kind of flipped it and used it to make your things more successful. You know, you took that name brand thing and reached out to people who might otherwise say no or wouldn't do it for someone else, you know?
Well, and I did it for the sake of the artists and poets. I did one giant thing I did was a project called Poetry Will Be Made by All. And it was on National Poetry Day, I guess it must have been in 2013.
So this is in April.
And they gave me the entire fourth floor, of MoMA on a Saturday afternoon. And they said, from noon to four, you got the entire fourth floor. Of course, you know, they didn't move any paintings or anything. But I reached out to various literary organizations, and I said, look, each of you have a room. Curate 4 hours. Invite as many people as you want. And have them bring their friends, and the whole thing's free. And as a result, something like 250 poets got to read at MoMA, and again, got to legitimately put on their resume that they did a solo reading at the Museum of Modern Art, which is true.
This was all in one day, right?
Yeah, this was all in 4 hours.
Wow.
You know, people come up, do 10-minute readings, and there's 8 to 10 of them going on at any given time. You start to really rack up numbers. Now, poets have nothing. Poets get nothing. It's the worst thing in the world. But again, every one of those poets could tell their mother that they had just done a solo reading at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Now, to me, that's worth everything, you know? And I use the MoMA name in order to distribute the MoMA name to hundreds of poets that normally would not have had access to that name. So, and it didn't hurt the museum. It was fine.
They survived. Yeah, everything's okay.
The MoMA's good, and all the poets got to do a reading at MoMA, which just doesn't happen.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Non-Reflective Glass. Trips to the museum shouldn't be an involuntary selfie safari, seeing yourself in every print and painting. Non-Reflective Glass solves this problem, allowing the art to shine through and connect with the viewer more directly. While many museums and galleries already utilize Non-Reflective Glass, the usage is far from universal. Find the International Museum Glass Guild on social media. Make your voice heard. Make sure to use the hashtag #CantBearTheGlare.
And the education department, I created so much trouble for them. they really were pulling out their hair about all this stuff. But you know what? They supported everything I did. And I think quietly, the head of education at that time was loving it. Because really what happened in the museum as a result of cultural changes and media changes is that the museum has changed. The museum is a destination. Only art lovers used to go to museums. Now anybody that's in New York goes to the Museum of Modern Art. And what do they do there? They take selfies of themselves in front of the Edward Munch or the Picasso, okay? And it's a destination space now as much as it is a cultural space.
Kind of a community center of sorts more than a place to look at art.
Exactly. It's both. Of course, people go there to look at art, but it's also a place that who better knows how to handle people than education. Nobody in that museum has a better idea of how to handle the changes that the institution is making better than the people that have been handling people all along, which is education. So in a funny way, the gym teacher has, been elevated to a principal, as far as I can tell. And the curator, who, once led it, has been diminished. So now you have all these events, First Fridays and, these kinds of things at museums, and that's all run by education. So my idea was, let's flip this hierarchy on its head. Let's put education, let's put democracy, let's put poets, let's put populace ahead of money and finance and the sort of traditional metrics of prestige. Now, all of this is happening. It really hasn't hurt the value of MoMA. MoMA's still a lucrative institution and their objects. We're not calling for a tearing down of the museum and their artifacts. I'm saying both can exist, and let's give a little bit more air to the less lucrative arts than always the masterpieces.
So they didn't continue this. There hasn't been a poet laureate of MoMA since then, but do you have any sense of whether this program, because it did have such a wide reach with the press, it was all over the place. I remember, like you said, seeing you on a Colbert Report and other shows. Mm. And have you heard of any other museums that have attempted something like this around the country since this happened?
I don't think it really got people excited. I don't think it opened up any doors. It was a tear in the universe. You know, it was just an anomaly. It was like the Twilight Zone or Black Mirror or one of these shows.
Would you ever do it again at another institution?
I don't think so. I think I've had my fill. I think I found the whole thing to be exhausting. Ultimately, the museum ended up kind of liking me. We got along. As a matter of fact, my last day there, I was invited to, I was invited to a trustees meeting. So here I am sitting in a room with the richest people on the planet, you know, like people like Jeff Bezos or, you know, with these type of people, the people that fund the place. And I was invited. And I was invited to speak about what I did and why I did it. And I invited somebody into the room that nobody there knew. And one of my strategies at that moment was, I said, you know, Glenn Lowry is sitting next to me, and I got news for you. You're a powerful man, but you're not the most powerful man in this institution. And he kind of, you know, smiled at me. And I said, the most powerful man in this institution is sitting in this room, and none of you know who he is. And I pointed over to the corner, and there's this guy. I said, you know, whatever his name is. I said, would you please stand up? And he stood up, and I said, this is so-and-so, and he runs your social media. You know, at that point, MoMA had had millions of followers on their Twitter feed. And I could tell that MoMA didn't acknowledge the power of the internet and the power of social media. And I remember, again, it was a way of like the democracy. A lot of people, more people learn about MoMA from the Twitter feed than actually ever go there.
Yeah, and in a single day, yeah, in some ways, yeah. One popular social media post could reach more people potentially than the amount of visitors they have in whatever given time. Yeah, you're right about that.
Well, I know that. I remember seeing, you know, statistics. I remember once the Andrea Rosen Gallery had released a statistic a few years ago saying, bragging that they had over 5,000 visitors a week. And I'm thinking to myself, in internet terms, that's a failure, you know, in terms of those metrics. And, you know, a lot of the people that were coming to the museum were using social media, were there because of social media. And I remember afterwards, Glenn Lowry took me for a cup of coffee afterwards. And he said, you know, look, I want to thank you for what you did. It's made us reconsider things here at the museum. You've shown us certain aspects of this museum that we hadn't been paying attention to. And it was a very heartfelt thanks. Did it change everything? I don't think so. But there was an acknowledgement and it felt good. And then, you know, then it was over. There was no follow-up. You know, I still have to pay to get into the museum. You know, as if it never happened. But that's the nature of the ephemeral arts, of poetry. Things, they happen in a space, and you have to acknowledge when those things are unfolding because they're very special things, and they don't last very long. Again, I'm interested in this idea of the back door, of things slipping in unexpectedly. But those doors don't stay open all the time, and you've got to take advantage of them, and you've got to cherish them when they do happen.
Well, I think to wrap up, I'd like to kind of talk about this overlap between the world of the visual arts and the world of the literary arts. Seems like something you've crossed over into a lot. And being here based in Tulsa and you're based in New York, we had a couple of guys, Ron Padgett and Joe Brainard, who, you know, are from Tulsa and moved up there and became part of what's known as the New York School. And especially Joe Brainard had, you know, was mostly a visual artist, but also wrote, you know, and kind of fell in with Ashbery and all these guys. And then Ron Padgett, who would go on to do work with like Jim Dine and Alex Katz. And there was this really interesting overlap, especially at that time, between the visual artists and the poets and the writers. And you can see that they're collaborating. There's books coming out where someone will illustrate the cover or they'll do these things mm-hmm. for this book. Do you think that level of crossover is happening today as much as it was, say, in the late 50s, early 60s? What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's more. I think that today every painter is a poet, and every poet is a musician, and every musician is a graphic designer. You know, because of the technology that we have accorded to us, everybody seems to be doing everything. I mean, listen, I remember it wasn't so long ago, my wife, who was known as a video maker, then did a show of paintings, and people couldn't wrap their mind around it. This is back in the early 90s. They said, you're a famous video maker. You can't make paintings. And today, these kinds of things seem so ridiculous to us. You know, of course, everybody does everything. You know, I think that the lines are getting harder to draw. I think they're fictitious. I think they're institutional. This is a poet. This is a painter. You know, many artists use tremendous amounts of poetry and language in their visual compositions. Many poets are visual poets, and all of the technology that we have permits us to actually do those things and publish those things and distribute those things in very interesting and messy ways. So I think it's more so than it was before. I think it's very encouraging.
After serving in World War II and attending several universities, including Harvard and the New School, Frank O'Hara worked for the Museum of Modern Art in New York City on and off for 15 years. Holding a variety of positions, he was eventually appointed assistant curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture Exhibitions. On his lunch breaks at the museum, he'd walk the streets and write observational poetry, incorporating mundane details, pop culture cameos, and a fresh, breezy, conversational style. In the late 1950s, Beat poet and publisher Lawrence Ferlinghetti commissioned a book of these pieces for his company, City Lights. The book, appropriately titled Lunch Poems, wouldn't come out until 1964. Just 2 years later, in the summer of 1966, while vacationing on Fire Island, O'Hara was struck by a Jeep on the beach and killed. He was only 40 years old. Though he's gone on to become a major name in mid-20th century literature, his obit in the New York Times failed to grasp his significance. The headline read, "Exhibitions aide at modern art dies, also a poet."
The poem's called Having a Coke with You. It's even more fun than going to St. Sebastian, Irun, Ondai, Biarritz, Bayonne, or being sick to my stomach on the Travessera de Gracia in Barcelona. Partly because in your orange shirt you look like a better, happier St. Sebastian, partly because of my love for you, partly because of your love for yogurt, partly because of the fluorescent orange tulips around the birches, partly because of the secrecy our smiles take on before people in statuary. It is hard to believe when I'm with you that there can be anything as still, as solemn, as unpleasantly definitive as statuary when right in front of it, in the warm New York 4 o'clock light. We are drifting back and forth between each other like a tree breathing through its spectacles. And the portrait show seems to have no faces in it at all, just paint. You suddenly wonder why in the world anyone ever did them. I look at you, and I would rather look at you than all the portraits in the world except possibly for the Polish rider occasionally, and anyway it's in the Frick, which thank heavens you haven't gone to yet so we can go together the first time. And the fact that you move so beautifully more or less takes care of futurism, just as at home I never think of the nude descending a staircase or at a rehearsal a single drawing of Leonardo or Michelangelo that used to wow me. And what good does all the research of the Impressionists do them? When they never got the right person to stand near the tree when the sun sank. Or for that matter, Marino Marini, when he didn't pick the rider as carefully as the horse. It seems they were all cheated of some marvelous experience, which is not going to go wasted on me, which is why I'm telling you about it.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
We've been listening to a Museum Confidential podcast here on Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in for Rich Fisher. You can find more podcasts at publicradiotulsa.org. Thanks for listening.